Hello. Now we shall move to more practical things, and the first thing is magnets. So the topic is practical magnet design. Magnets are very important in accelerators, in all accelerators and beam lines where iron beam must be bent, then we need magnets because electric field is not strong enough to bend the beam when the energy is more than a few hundred kilo electron volts per nucleon. And in magnets, we use iron because iron can be magnetized and increases the magnetic field very much until it saturates. In this picture, we can see how ferromagnetic material will get magnetized. So if in the beginning there is no magnetic field, and here this H is the applied magnetic field intensity, and M is magnetization. Then when we apply a magnetic field to it, then the magnetization increases very, very quickly. In the beginning, the domains, so sort of very, very small magnets, we could say, the magnetic fields are pointing to all possible directions, and the net magnetic field is zero. And then, due to the external magnetic field, the domains will get aligned, and of course, at some point, they are all aligned to the same direction, and after that, they don't anymore increase the magnetic field, whatever the external magnetic field is. I mean, how high the magnetic field is. So it gets saturated. And when we then decrease the magnetic field, external magnetic field to zero, then we have some residual magnetization. And for so-called hard magnetic materials, then this is big. So they are used for, so they are permanent magnets. And then in order to get the magnetization to zero, we must reverse the magnetic field. And then when we increase the reverse magnetic field, we are down here. And then the domains are up again, aligned to the opposite direction, and then when we go back here, we will have this kind of hysteresis here. And the maximum magnetic field that we can get with iron, soft iron, is about 2 Tesla. And higher fields than 2, actually 2.2 Tesla, then we must use superconducting magnets. So the magnetic field B, so magnetic field density, and this is the one that we have in the equations. So charge times V cross B is the force that the charged particle feels when it's moving in the magnetic field. And here we have the permeability of a vacuum, and then two fields. This H field, magnetic field strength, and M, magnetization. And the source for this field H is so-called free currents, the currents that flow in the coils, in the conductors. And the magnetization is due to the atomic currents in material. And this mu zero times the maximum, or the magnetization, the maximum is 2.14 Tesla for soft iron. And this is what we need. This is a function of H. So in the beginning, it will increase the magnetic field very, very quickly. So instead of writing this, we could write just mu times mu zero times h, where the mu is a relative permeability. And at low fields, it can be hundreds, something like 2,000 or so. But then when this saturates, then it doesn't help anymore. So we need currents in the coils to produce the magnetic field. So amperes and turns. So we have several turns of conductor, and the total current then in a coil is the amps in a conductor times the number of turns. And this can be approximated and calculated also more precisely. We will soon approximate what kind of current we need. And then we have many computer codes like FEM and Poisson. They are two-dimensional. And Tosca or Opera, that's three-dimensional. So here I have a magnet. So let's have, for example, this here is a round pole. We are just looking at the cross-section. And then iron around it. And this pole also is iron. And here we have round coils around this pole and around this pole. And we have this relation here, Ampere's equation, well, Ampere's law actually. So when we have a closed line integral here, h dot dl, it's the same as the free current flowing through this loop. And now when the iron is far from saturation, then the relative permeability is very, very high. And magnetic field B is continuous here. The normal component of the magnetic field here is continuous. So B here is the same as B here. And in the iron, because mu relative permeability is very, very big, so h is very much smaller than m, we can approximate that h here in the iron is zero. It's an approximation, but fairly good, fairly good. Okay. Let's have this gap here, this h, 20 centimeters, 0.2 meters, and we want the field here in the gap between the poles to be 2 Tesla. And we take the h dot dl integral, and here it's practically zero. Although the length here is rather big, but h is very, very small. So we have h only here. So this integral is the same as h, which is b over mu zero here times this gap h. And then we can see that Ni, the total current here through this loop is 320,000 amperes, or we can say 320,000 ampere turns because we can have here tens or hundreds of turns. So now we have a very easy way to approximate how big current we need to get a magnetic field in a given gap. This is a homogeneous field, more or less, in a dipole. So now we have the N times I, number of turns times the current in a coil. But what is N? How many turns and how big current? So the question is, which conductors do we use? Okay, we will come to that. The coil has resistance, R, and we have this current I. So this is the dissipated power, so heat production, the power that turns into heat, thermal power. And it must be removed from the system. Easy way would be air cooling, just blowing, but it's relatively ineffective. As well as is indirect cooling, which means that we have some sort of cooled block that we attach to the coil. So then it would cool it through conduction. But they are ineffective. Direct water cooling is effective, which means that we have a hollow conductor. So in the conductor we have a hole for the water, cooling water. Let's look at this cooling water properties first. So this equation here gives the temperature rise when we have this I squared times R, this power in the coil, and we have a flow, water flow Q in liters per minute. And this 4.2, you might remember where it comes from. It's a specific heat of water, 4.2 kilojoules per degree per kilogram or liter, because 1 liter of water is practically one kilogram. And this 6 here comes from that in SI units we have seconds, and now we have minutes here, so 60 seconds. And this decimals here, we have 60 here, and this was 6.2 kilojoules. So very, very, very simple equation. So this is the temperature rise when we have this much cooling, or we can then calculate the flow rate with which we can get when the temperature rises this much. And the power is this much here. Usually the incoming water temperature is 20 degrees. It could be lower, but then we would have problems, because then some of the water tubes and the conductors, they would be at lower temperature than the room temperature. And especially in the summertime, when the absolute water content of air is big, then we would have condensed water. So we would have dripping water here and there. So for practical reasons, the incoming cold water should be around room temperature, 20 degrees. And water starts to boil at 100 at room temperature, normal pressure, then it would be less than 100 Celsius. There are also some other requirements which tell that the temperature should be something like less than 20 degrees. Namely, if the coil gets very hot, it warms the iron, and then we have a heat expansion. So the gap in the pole, in a magnet, it increases, which means that the magnetic field goes down. So when we need to have very stable magnetic fields, we should not heat the iron. The magnetic properties also depend slightly on temperature. Okay, resistivity of copper, cold copper, is 1.72 times 10 to minus 8 ohm meters. And when it's at 50 degrees centigrade, then it's close to 2 instead of 1.70. And we should use this to be on the safe side. So the resistance is the length of the conductor in the coil times this resistivity divided by the cross section of copper. So it's quite evident that the smaller the temperature rise we need, the larger the Q must be. Okay, the conductor, or the hole in the conductor is like a water hose. You are watering your lawn, and when you have tens of meters of the hose, then very little water comes out. So there's some resistance. The flow is practically not laminar. So then we better use this kind of semi-empirical equation. It gives quite good results in practical cases for magnets, for example. So this is the pressure drop between the inlet and outlet. This is the length of the cooling path, so the water hose if you are watering your lawn. And Q is, again, the water flow in liters per minute. A here is the flow cross section in square millimeters. And then we have these empirically received exponents here. So this holds quite nicely, and it is not so difficult. And you can see that the pressure drop depends on the flow to the power of 1.8 practically. And note, the Q is proportional to I squared. So the Q is proportional to the power that is converted to heat. And the power is proportional to I squared. So the pressure drop that we need for a certain temperature rise goes like the current in the coil to the power of 3.6 roughly. So the need for the pressure increases very, very quickly. Usually, the pressure difference between the inlet and outlet is around 7 to 8 bars. Anyway, less than 15 bars. when the pressure is less than 8 bars, then we can use some certain components, and if we want to go to closer to 15 bars, then the materials must be chosen very carefully. All the connectors and the plastic tubes and so forth. But now if the pressure that we need becomes too high, the cooling circuit could be divided into several parallel circuits, which means that here we have the cooling path. We divided the length of the coil to n pieces, and these n pieces for cooling water, that they are connected in parallel. But for electricity, for the current itself, they are in series. I will soon explain why this is possible. So this becomes L over N, and also we have only one nth of length to be cooled. So the required flow rate for this element goes also to Q over N, and here we have exponent 1.79. So the pressure decreases like 1 over n to the power of 2.79. And this is a schema how it goes. So this is our conductor in the coil. The total resistance is this, and the total power is I squared times R. Now we take this part separately, and we have the cooling water. Here is a cold water coming in, and the flow of this is one nth of the total flow, because it's divided into n pieces. And these water hoses or the tubes, they they don't conduct electricity, and we have ion exchange or distilled water, which also that doesn't conduct electricity. Okay, so we can cooling wise divide this into n parallel pieces, but for the current itself, it's in series. And we do that division by usually by a double pancake structure. I will soon show pictures of it. So we sort of start mining from the outer radius, go inside, and then come back along the next layer, and these layers are touching each other. And these double pancakes, they are then connected in series electrically and in parallel for cooling. And as I just said, the conductivity of the cooling water must be very, very low. So it's ion exchanged water, or so that it's deionized water, or distilled water, and we have then closed cooling circuits, so that we have heat exchangers to get the heat away from this ion exchanged water. This is a practical example. So here comes the current in, and then it goes around. And now two of these double pancakes, so four layers, it's coming back here, and then it's connected electrically to this conductor, which then again comes out from there, and so forth. But cooling wise, they are in parallel. So here cold water is going in, and here cold water is going in, and then hot water comes out. Okay. Or even simpler picture is this part of a solenoid. Of course, the binding doesn't in practice go so that we start from here and go inside, and then on the next layer we come up, because it's impossible to bind, but starting from outside. And here there's one detail. This conductor which makes the double pancake layers, it's divided into two conductors radially. So they are we have here divided this into two parallel pieces once more, so the length becomes 1/2. So every second turn goes in and every second turn goes out for this conductor and the others for this conductor. So seen from this side, for example, it looks like this. And this is called a double pancake. So it has two layers, and it looks like a pancake. And here you can see the structure of it. So this is the radial direction, and this turn after one, this conductor after one turn comes here. So every second. But if it was a single conductor, then it would come out here, and then here, and so forth. Okay. So here we have typical hollow conductor. It's a rectangle. It would be also so a square actually. But it could be a rectangle, so that these two dimensions could be different. So the cross section of the copper is d times d minus this area here, pi over 4 times phi squared, and then minus these pieces here. So we have here r times r minus 1/4 of this circle here. So 1/4 times p r squared. So the copper cross section is then this. We take the d times d square take away pieces where we don't have any copper. So this hole and these rounded corners. And this is how it's done in our cyclotron. The number of these conductors here, they are not really the true numbers, but it's just the scheme. And here again, we also have it divided parallel radially. So we have a double conductor that we wind here. By the way, let's come back back here how it's really wound. So for this layer that we see on this side, it's wound so that the center is wound into this direction, and we have the coil coming, the current connector coming from here, here, and then it comes out. And the other, so we start from the half of the length, and the other is in package, and then we wound the other half by winding this way. It's not so easy, but can be done with proper machinery. And it's evident that this conductor must be insulated so that the separate turns here don't touch each other electrically. So there must be insulator between the copper conductors. Okay. So here we have some limitations for the size of the copper. Of course, when the magnet has not been made in the design process, this is an iterative process to get the dimensions of the coil, which means that we get the dimension for the pole pieces. And in this coil, we have 10 turns of double conductor. So 20 conductors here, because we have a double conductor, and 20 layers axially. So what we need here is 400,000 ampere turns. It's to calculate it, we cannot use a very, very simple example that we had before, because we have hills and valleys. So the gap here is different between the hills and between the valleys. But we get the result that we need 400,000 ampere turns. And in one conductor pair, so we have 200 turns per these conductor pairs. Then in one conductor pair, two coils, one here and one below here. So these two comes from the number of coils. So in one conductor pair, we have 1,000 ampere, and we had one conductor pair is this, so 1,000 amps through this, so 500 amps through one of these. So in one conductor, we have 500 amps. And the length of a double pancake, so we go in and then out, and then we have every second turn here is one conductor. So this two comes from the fact that it's a double pancake. We go in and out, And this is the number in one pancake, and 2 pi times the average radius. So the average radius, this here, measured from the center. And the average radius happens to be 1.4 meters, roughly. So the length of one double pancake is 180 meters. And we now choose this kind of conductor. Small d, 70 millimeters, 7 millimeter hole and 1 millimeter rounding gives us 250 square millimeters of copper. And now the resistance of the double pancake for single conductor, the length is this, 180 meters. And now we use this for a hot coil, so 50 degrees C. The resistivity, and then the cross section, which means that we have 14 milliohms for one conductor. So the power for one conductor in double pancake, R squared times R, is 500 amps squared times the 14 milliohms, so 3.5 kilowatts. And counting all this together, we have two conductors in a double pancake and two coils. So 140 kilowatts that this would give us. Actually, the nominal power is 130 kilowatts. But in reality, this 17 by 17 conductor is not the one that we use, but very close. Okay, now cooling for this coil. We allow temperature rise 20 degrees. So we calculate the flow rate. And here we just have the flow rate for one conductor in one double pancake. So it was 3.5 kilowatts. And we get 2.5 liters per minute. Putting that in the pressure equation. So here we have the phi, the radius, this here is the cross section of the flow channel, the hole. And we get, and this is the flow rate, we get 6.3 bars. So it's quite reasonable and acceptable. But now both coils they consist of 10 double pancakes, and each double pancake have two conductors in parallel. In fact, they are electrically also in parallel. So we feed in 1,000 amps in one of the pairs. But cooling wise, it's also parallel. So we have 40 pieces of 180 meter long conductors, each carrying 2.5 liters per minute. So the total flow to cool the magnet of the cyclotron is 100 liters per minute. And now, if you are building this accurate laboratory and getting all the hardware there, you now can approximate the cooling system. The cooling system must be capable of producing about 6.5 bar pressure difference at this flow rate, 100 liters per minute, in order to keep the temperature increase below 20 degrees for the cyclotron only. And usually the cooling system has also other devices to cool as well, so it must be able to produce much, much higher flow rate. The cooling system consists of tens or even at least tens, even hundreds of meters of tubing, and it also has some flow resistance. So there will be a pressure drop due to the cooling system itself. So the pressure drop must be measured at the device which is being cooked. Now, let's play a little with choices. The conductor was of this type. So this is the radius direction. What would happen if we replace it with this kind of conductor, where the cross-section of copper is the same and the cross-section of one hole only is the same? Now it's a good to check whether this new hole would fit into this conductor. No, it doesn't. But nevertheless, we used this kind of conductor. And so the flow rate, of course, would be doubled because here we had the flow rate 2.5 liters per minute, and then this is 5. And now the change in the pressure drop is proportional to the flow rate times the cross section to the power of minus 1.334, and that to the power of 1.79. So the new pressure drop, there we have twice the flow and twice the cross section. And calculating this, we get that the pressure drop is less actually for this. So it would be beneficial to use one hole instead. But this kind of stiff conductor is very difficult to wind. But if there are two of them, it's much easier because they can slide with respect to each other when we are winding it. Let's take another alternative. We could use a square conductor with the same cross section. Now, number of turns would increase, and the conductor as well. Maybe we get higher delta P, and the resistance of one double pancake would increase, so more flow, higher pressure. Let's calculate this as an example. So the conductor would have dimensions. We had 17 by 17, now it's square root of 2 times 17, and square root of 2 times 7 here for the hole. So 24 by 24 and 9.9 hole. Okay. Well, here we have a check. This 9.9 hole would fit into 17 by 17 in this case here. No problem. Okay. And now in one coil, we have 200,000 ampere turns. And now as first step, we just approximate the number of turns. So 1,000 amps we need, the 2,000 ampere turns here, and that would mean 200 turns. But if we look at this limitation here of the sizes, we should fit it approximately to this cross section, and we should get 200. So now the number of turns is quantized. And we should have full double pancakes. So turns here, 2 times 7 times 15. So 7. 7-7 in one direction and 15 in one direction. So in and out, maybe a double pancake, and that would give 210. But for 200, it's just more difficult to find proper values for radial and axial number of turns. This is quite close, and it would mean that the current would be a bit less. So 7 double pancakes and 15 turns. So it would be 14 by 15 would be the total number of turns. The conductor must be insulated, so we have here 24 by 24. So practically it's 26 millimeters. So radial it's 390 millimeters. And this is the inner radius. I didn't keep it before, but this is the inner radius, and then one half of this radial extent gives the average radius. So the length of the double pancake would then be 270 meters, and calculating the the resistance 10.5 milliohms, and the power dissipation for double pancake 9.54 kilowatts, and altogether 134 kilowatts. But this is quite obvious because we wanted to keep the total cross section of the coil roughly constant, and we knew that we should have 200,000 amperes flowing through this the total current flowing through this conductor cross section, and it doesn't really matter how the copper is is divided. So it did. Now we have the roughly the same copper cross section. And the flow rate then calculated. We have now 6.8 liters per minute, and the pressure drop, putting the numbers in, we get almost 11 bars. So this starts to be on the limit. But it's, of course, this very, very thick square conductor is much more difficult to bind. But it could have been done. It could have been done. In both cases, it's around the same total power. And so the power supply should be able to give 1,000 amps with a voltage of 140 volts. This is the minimum for the voltage. So now you are able to ask for prices for a power supply that gives this much current at this much voltage, and from the knowledge before, you know that the magnetic field must be very, very stable, so it must be very stable up to 10 to minus 5, for example. 10 to minus 4 is not acceptable. 10 to minus 5, 10 to minus 6,